Mudita Santi for our Saturday night meditation. Time for us to stop and come together as a community and to, I guess, reaffirm what is the kind of core value and the core purpose of being here together. Why are we actually living here? Why are we, you know, making a monastery? Why do we care about the people here? Why do we care about the place in the community? And, of course, the whole purpose of that is to make a place for meditation, for Dhamma practice. And we do this not as, not just in order to kind of fulfill some form or make it kind of look like the right thing, but we do this because we believe that it is a vehicle for transformation and for the dissolution of our problems, the problems that are meaningful in our lives. This is why we do that. So this weekly meeting is a good chance for all of us to come together and to spend some time sharing that, sharing those common values, reaffirming those common values. So as usual this week, I'd like to lead you in some guided metta meditation. We've been going through the metta little bit by little bit, and we've reached so far up to the third stage of metta, and the loving kindness for the neutral person. So I'd like to do this week, loving kindness for the neutral one. So what I want you to do, just before we start, do the metta for ourselves, then metta for a loved person. So I want you all to think of one loved person who you can do metta for, and one neutral person also that you can do metta for, someone who you don't have very strong feelings of liking or disliking towards. So you get just one person in each of those categories, and if you can think of them before we start, and then they'll be ready for your mind when we get to them in the meditation. Okay? So now if you're ready to sit, please sit comfortably. Focus on the present moment, on the feelings that you're experiencing as you're sitting here. Noticing that tone of experience that we call like a mood or emotion. Keeping your mind still, paying attention to that mood that you're carrying in from your thoughts and activities during the day. Gently remind yourself that that mood, whatever it is, it's not permanent. It's not you. It doesn't last. It doesn't have any essence. It's not real. It's no more real than anything else. Don't believe in that mood. Just know it. and then let it go. Feels reasonably quiet and empty. Just gently bring up the words in your heart. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Leaving your awareness in your heart. Keeping your sense of awareness grounded and centered. Saying the words evenly. Carefully. Steadily. With meaning. Generating the pure, wholesome intention. For your own true happiness and well-being. you continue then just touch that place in your heart where that feeling of metta is starting to manifest. It's something that's not the words, it's not the idea, it's the feeling. Pure, simple, childlike feeling of happiness and joy. Very even. Very soft. As the feeling becomes more clear, just gradually spread the feeling out through the whole body. Soaking, consciously moving the feeling of happiness through each part of the body. Until you can feel metta, the happiness and the joy of metta soaking through every cell in your body. through the second stage, keeping the mind just as it is, but simply changing the name of the person for whom you're developing metta. May that loved person be happy. May they be happy putting their name in the words of metta. May that loved person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. neutral person be happy. May that neutral person be happy. May that neutral person be happy. Just with their name in the words of metta. Keeping that clear, decisive, from the third person to one, the loved one again. May the loved person be happy. May they be happy. And to oneself, may I be happy. May I be happy. And finally, let the words of metta go. Let the feeling of metta fade away. Allow the mind to return to a neutral, empty, open space. And in that quiet place, take a couple of minutes to review over how the meditation went. Just inquiring into cause and effect. What's going on? What happened? How did the mind change? How did I approach the meditation? How is the mind now different from how it was at the start of the meditation? Only we can share the merits of the practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be safe. May all beings rejoice in the merit that we made through our practice. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So this week, as we continue our exploration of the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, we come to the five spiritual faculties, five indriyas. And as always, like all of these groups of dhammas, you see what we're dealing with here is something that's very simple, a set of psychological conditions, states of mind, aspects of our consciousness which we all possess, we all have. And our task is, as part of the path, of course, Bhavetamban, to develop those things. They should be developed, make more of them. These five spiritual faculties are faith, sadha, energy, virya, sati, mindfulness, samadhi, and panya, which we usually translate as wisdom or understanding. So we usually translate these as faculties for some reason, which I'm not quite sure of, but the Pali word is indriya, which is related from derived from the word Inda, which of course is one of the names of the high deities in the Vedic tradition. So Indriya, as his role of Indra, is kind of a ruler or the controller. So sometimes translated as controlling faculties, predominant faculties. There's a really good name for them. But in any case, they're something which have, like, power, wield a certain power over a certain domain, have a strength to them. And so they're also called balas, or powers, the five spiritual faculties. And five spiritual powers are just the same. There's no difference, it's just a difference in the wording. So, again, when we just sort of take a cursory look at these things, we just sort of look at them on a kind of surface level, and you see, well, there's kind of makes sense, doesn't it, that these are qualities which are useful to develop in spiritual life. They're quite rational. The Buddha's not asking us to sort of sign on the dotted line for anything kind of weird or esoteric or anything like that. And we can all see that those things are useful. It's useful to have some faith in what we're doing. It's useful to have energy. It's useful to have mindfulness, to have concentration, and to have wisdom. They're all good things. And none of them are at all dangerous. We're not going to go crazy by developing these things. We're not going to do anything harmful. We're not going to bring any harm to anybody. So there's something which are like entirely positive, entirely wholesome. And we can see these are qualities of mind which we need every day. We need to be able to do our things, do our work, just live our life well. We have to have these qualities at a certain basic level. We have to have a certain faith. We can understand faith as like a positive emotional commitment to something. We've got a willingness to do something. We have faith in it. So if we're doing a job, if we're painting a kitchen or doing some cleaning or whatever it may be, we have like a faith that, yeah, this is a job that needs doing. It's worthwhile doing. It's like a value we put on something. So when we have faith in something, we have a value on it. But of course, faith is not just good enough in and of itself. So all the other factors come into play as well. Like, you have to have mindfulness to realize that something needs doing. If there's a job to be doing, if you need to do the sweeping, your mindfulness is one that notices that there's leaves on the path. Energy is the one that actually grabs the broom and moves it backwards and forwards. Concentration is the one that keeps doing it until the job's finished. Yeah? And wisdom is the one that understands what the problem is, understands how to solve it, and understands when the solution is finished. So wisdom is the one that stops sweeping guides your sweeping as you're doing it, so that you sweep the leaves off the path and not back onto it. And it's the one that knows, okay, now the path is swept. I don't have to do that anymore. So even just in a very simple sense, you can see that these faculties are all necessary for all of us every day. Everything we do, we need to have these faculties. And if we were completely bereft of them, we'd be crazy, or we'd be completely incompetent, or just sort of lying bare all day, wouldn't be able to do anything. It could get terminally depressed or something like that. So the reason why you're all here, you all have some of these faculties, you all have faith, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting in this room. You all have some energy, otherwise you'd be lying down snoring. You all have some mindfulness, at least a little bit, at least a tiny little bit. And some concentration, your minds aren't completely scattered all the time, and some wisdom. We've all got those things, at least a little bit. And you can see them and understand what they're like in yourself. You understand these are positive qualities to develop as part of the path. And then do it, develop it, recognize it, make more of them. As usual in Buddhism, the Buddha offers us a kind of handy mnemonic, a way of memorizing what these things are, a way of keeping them in mind so we can have like, we can recall them quickly and easily if we want to know what these things are. And in the case of the five indriyas, the five spiritual faculties, the basic definition it gives is in terms of each one has a group of four. So it's like five groups of four. And so you can always remember that because there's always the four something or others. So the four in faith, you have the four kinds of right faith, which is actually not really the four kinds of right faith, but the faith in the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. And then the last one is keeping precepts. So keeping precepts, keeping sila is included under faith in this particular system. And then the four right efforts, four satipatthanas, of course, the four mindfulness, the four jhanas, four samadhi, and the four noble truths for wisdom. So there you go, it's very easy to remember. And if you need a sort of a handy definition of these things, you always remember this is like the best definition of them. So as with all the things in the path, they tend to flow on from each other. One tends to move on, build on. They're not like static things. They don't just sit there like lumps of stuff. They're energies. All of these things are energies, ultimately. They're not me. They're not mine. They're not dependent on some kind of belief in a, you know, God or anything like that. We don't have to subscribe to any metaphysical theories or anything like this. We just have to recognize them in our own experience. They're empirical truths. One of the ancient schools of Indian Buddhism was called the Dashtantika, which means those who left it with experience, left things with experience. Literally, what is seen is the end. What is seen is the end. So if you can see to the end of this room, you just leave it to the end of the room. Your experience is, that's the end of what I can see. Dashtantika. So this is a very good principle to bear in mind in Buddhism, that we leave things just as far as we can see them. And we're not trying to build up things outside of that. What we can see as we sit here is just this room. This is our experience. We have an idea behind that there's a house. But actually our experience is the room. Never forget that. Never forget that in your practice. So when you come to these groups of dhammas, you know, we can argue about and theorize about nirvana and psychic powers and all of these high attainments and all of these kinds of things. And we can attain these various things and get diamond bodies and mantras and all of these kinds of stuff and fly through the clouds and stuff. But our actual experience is sitting here in this room. And when we come to these spiritual faculties or any other group of dhammas, that's our experience. Stay with that experience is, what are these things like? What is that faith like? What is that energy like? What is that mindfulness like? What is that samadhi like? What is that wisdom like? What is it like to actually know these things, to experience them? And this is where wisdom comes from. It comes from understanding like this. So our faith in the Dhamma stems ultimately from the Buddha himself. We have this faith somehow that there was a man who did it. There was a man who broke through, who realized the truth. That's just a faith, that's not like reality. Our reality isn't actually being here sitting with the Buddha in the kind of flesh and blood sense. But we have this faith that there was somebody who was able to do that. There was this kind of spiritual explosion which has created ripples which we can feel up to the present day. And for myself, as you know, I try to, my own personal inspiration is strongly rooted in the idea of the historical Buddha, the actual man who was born in Lumbini and grew up in Kapilavastu with Suddhodana as his father, Mahapajapati as his foster mother. He had his childhood friends, his cousins and so on. And then at 29 he went forth, travelled south, wandered down to Rajagaha, practiced asceticism in the hills around Rajagaha, did his meditation, sat under the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya, realized enlightenment, went to Benares, taught the Four Noble Truths to the five ascetics, came back to Rajagaha, converted the Kassapa brothers, and then continued to teach, set up monasteries, established the twofold Sangha and the fourfold Parisa, fourfold assembly, and to do that for the rest of his life. And I have faith that this actually happened. I don't have faith that every detail is, as is recorded in the traditional histories, is necessarily true. In fact, I think a lot of it isn't. But I do have faith that this outline of this history is substantially true, and there was somebody who did those things. And I've been to India, and I've walked on that same earth. I've been to the same places where the Buddha meditated. I've been to the Vulture's Peak. I've been to Savatthi. I've been to the Deer Park in Benares. And all of these places, you can see where the Buddha lived, and all of them have something about them. And there's some kind of spiritual strength or power to these places, due to their association with the Buddha, and then the memory of that through many years. And that's quite tangible. Again, not even talking on a mystical or metaphysical level, but quite tangibly, you can see if you go to the Vulture's Peak, it's just this kind of beautiful, remote hilltop with these little caves, very rugged and very empowering to be up there. And the Jetta's Grove, and when you go there, again, you can see it's this beautiful kind of gentle rolling landscape that's been used for so many years just for the practice of Dhamma. So as we know, in traditionally in Buddhism, for some reason, which I think is kind of psychologically interesting, but I won't go into it too much here, but for some reason people seem to find it, or through history have found it, very inspiring to believe in like a godlike Buddha, a Buddha who walked around performing all kinds of psychic miracles all the time, a Buddha who was three times as high as an ordinary person, a Buddha who was manifesting radiance and shining his aura all over the place, a Buddha who was kind of flying through the air at every possible opportunity, like Superman, like Neo, and all of these kinds of things. And people have found that very inspiring. And for myself, I don't particularly find those things all that inspiring. And I don't particularly find those stories that interesting. In certain cases they are, but that's not what my faith is grounded on. I could suddenly find out that all of those stories were untrue, and it wouldn't really make any difference. I find it inspiring to see when the Buddha is talking with the monks, like in the Upakilesa Sutta. And the Buddha comes along to see the group of three monks practicing together, Anuruddha, Kimbila, and Nandiya. And as the Buddha walks in to the gate of the forest monastery, and the attendant, the Anagarika, who's staying there, called Aramika, monastery attendant, immediately tries to keep the Buddha out. Sorry, you can't come in here. The monks are meditating. And so Anuruddha hears him and says, not him, silly, he's the Buddha. He's allowed to come in. So they let the Buddha in and they sit down and the Buddha says, how's it going, Marx? And they say, it's going good. And they say, well, how are you practicing? And they say, well, we get up in the morning and we go for our alms around, we collect our alms food, we come back, and we set out the places for eating, we set out the spittoons for throwing the rubbish away, we set out the water for washing their feet with, and we sit and we eat. And then whoever's finished last clears up after everything, puts the spittoons away and so on, and makes the place clean. If you need to fill up the water jar, then we just do that by waves of the hand, but we don't need to speak because of that. We just wave the hand and come over and fill the water jar. And then every 5 nights, they would sit and spend the whole night discussing Dhamma, once every 5 nights. It's a very beautiful portrait of a lifestyle involved in Dhamma. And the Buddha says, that's good. It's good that you're practicing in that way. He says, but, he says, when you're practicing in that way, you got any good stuff in your meditation? And they said, well, yeah, kind of. When you practice, you get this light. It's like nimitta in the meditation, but then it goes away, and we don't know what for. And the Buddha says, well, you've got to investigate the reason for that. And he says, you know, the same thing happened to me. I was meditating, the mind gets concentrated, the light comes up. Oh, it's good. And then it goes away. And I thought, why has it gone away? I've got to investigate the reason. And then he gives this whole series of reasons, what they call upakilesas, or like subtle hindrances in the mind, which have caused that, have caused the that light to go away. And sometimes it may be sloth, the mind is becoming a bit dull. Sometimes excitement, the mind is becoming a bit over agitated. Sometimes too eager. Sometimes too feeling of elation, of like overly strong joy in the mind. Sometimes like fear can come. And the Buddha said that all of these things he had when he was practicing. This is what I find inspiring. I don't find it inspiring to think of the Buddha as being like this kind of perfect individual who's basically always been perfect for all eternity. It's like, oh, I'm sitting here, I'm not perfect, how am I ever going to get anywhere? Yeah, it's like he's always been, almost since the dawn of time, has been virtually perfect. Well, like there's a whole sutta, the Mahabharata Sutta, when the Buddha's talking about how he was sitting contemplating the fear in the forest, sitting there on the full moon night in this awe-inspiring grove. You think about it, like really awe-inspiring in ancient India. Lions, elephants, bears, not to mention the invisible beings. Here we just have some awe-inspiring wombats. I mean, maybe have a panther. We heard a report of a black panther being seen in the area, so hopefully something a bit more awe-inspiring. But the awe-inspiring wombat in the forest crunching through, it sounds pretty big. It sounds as big as an elephant. And I'm sure if you were in the deep jungle and you did hear a real elephant, it sounded a lot bigger than an elephant. It sounded like a Tyrannosaurus Rex. So you'd be in there and you think, and he could feel the fear coming. And he said, why am I being afraid? What is it? Actually, it was just a peacock in the bush. Just a bird. Just a small animal moving through the trees. And I'm being so afraid of it. And so he was like having to deal with these fears. And he thought, right, why don't I just stay here? I don't have to move. Whatever posture I'm in, if I'm walking, I'll just keep walking until that fear goes away. I'm not going to try and hide it. I'm not going to try and run from it. I'll just stay there with it. If I'm sitting, I'll just stay sitting. I'm not going to open my eyes and look around and see what it is. If I'm lying down, if I'm having a rest at night and I hear that sound, I'm not going to get up and go and see. I'm just going to stay where I am and deal with that fear exactly where it happens. So this is how he practiced. So the Buddha was, and described himself in one of the key suttas about his going forth, called the Arya Pariyasana Sutta. In the Majjhima Nikaya, he described himself as King Kusala Gavesi. An important phrase, King Kusala Gavesi. Gavesi means a seeker, and literally it means one who's looking for cows. So the Buddha went forth looking for cows. It doesn't really mean that, it's just a literal interpretation. It means the seeker. And kusala, like what's skillful? But in Buddhism we have like the idea of good. You have two aspects of what is good. And we tend to say, one set of words, we say punya and papa is like good and evil. in the sense of like merit and demerit, like worldly goods and worldly bads, papa, punya and papa. But they're like goods which are limited within the sphere of samsara. And then you have the other set of words, kusala and akusala, and they're much more subtle. Kusala meaning like good, but also meaning skillful. And something which is leading to the ending of suffering, leading to what is causing happiness, as we call kusala. So the Buddha was seeking what is kusala. And the important part about that is the first element in that word is king kusala gavesi, king meaning what? What is the good? He was asking the question, what is the good? What is skillful? King kusala gavesi, what is skillful? Finding an answer to that question. What's the right way to live? How should I live? What should I do with my life? This is how he went forth. He didn't have some kind of pre-programmed set of what he's going to do, you know? He's just like a backpacker wandering through India. What do I do, you know? Sometimes I end up at a Rajneesh ashram and smoke a lot of dope and, oh wow, this is Nibbana, man, you know? And then I go somewhere else and go to a rave party and take ecstasy and dance around all night and think, oh, that's Nibbana. And then I go somewhere to a yoga ashram and do physical exercises and think, wow, this is the way to Nibbana. That's what the Buddha was doing. Yeah, this is how he was practicing. He's just like a heavy backpacker. He maybe had a bit more credibility to him, but he was not the prototype. Where is the truth? And this is really what distinguishes the Buddha in his spiritual path, is that he would just not accept second best. He would not accept anything that was still within the world, that was still within these limitations of the world. No, I'm just not going to have it. It's just not good enough. So this is, you know, where we get to this point which a lot of people have discussed and talked about, which is that when the Buddha was practicing before his enlightenment, he stayed with these two teachers, Alarika Lama and Uttaramaputta, and under those two teachers practiced very high levels of samadhi attainments. And it's not 100% sure who these people were or exactly what they were teaching, but it seems likely that they were in some way related to the kinds of sages that we read about in the Upanishads. Certainly sounds like a similar kind of teaching. And so the Buddha went along there. And what's interesting about that is if you look at the way the passage is described, when he first went there, he learnt the theory. He learnt by lip recital. He was reciting the texts. And he said, okay, I've got that now. But he said it's not just by lip reciting, it's not just by mouthing the words that these teachers are talking about these attainments, but it's through their own experience that they talk about it. And that's something which actually does come across very strongly if you read the Upanishads even today. They read like, you know, the good bits of them, they read like the experiences of the sages, of the meditators, somebody who's had this meditation experience and is trying to express it. They're not like a kind of consistent theory that's being worked out around states of consciousness and all of these things. It's like the outpouring of the consciousness of someone who's had that meditation experience. That's what the Upanishads read like. And this is what convinced the Buddha or the Bodhisattva when he was there practicing. Hey, these guys have got something. This isn't just words. And he said that they have these five qualities. Faith, energy, mindfulness, samadhi, and wisdom. Of course, these are the same as the five spiritual faculties. Yeah? And that's actually what the Buddha says in that context. So, according to Buddhism, these five spiritual faculties are not unique to Buddhism. And they've never claimed that they are. And this is actually borne out, if I remember rightly, in the Yoga Sutra, it actually has the list of the five spiritual faculties in there. So that's what he practiced. He said, these guys have got that. Well, I've got these as well. Let's go for it. And he did the meditation, practiced those things, and got up to this very high attainment of samadhi, and then thought, hang on, that's not it. That's not good enough. And why isn't it good enough? He said that dhamma, not just that attainment, okay, as is often misrepresented, the Buddha didn't reject the practice of the meditation. He said that dhamma, it means a teaching, that religion. Yavadeva akinchanya yatanupapatiya sangvatati only leads to rebirth in the realm of nothingness. And that was the problem. The dhamma, that teaching taken as a whole, leads to rebirth in the realm of nothingness. So the Buddha doesn't explain further why that is, but obviously it's because of this thing we call, what we call bhava tanha, craving for existence, craving for rebirth. It's still not like a complete letting go. And later on, when the Buddha, just before he became enlightened, it's very important when he remembered the time when he was sitting as a young boy, and remembered the time when he'd entered first jhana. And he thought, maybe that could be the way to enlightenment. And then he thought, eso amago bodhaya, that indeed is the path to enlightenment. Eso amago bodhaya. So the texts kind of leave us with a bit of a conundrum. They kind of leave us with a question mark. Hey, what's going on? How come the Buddha said that these practice of these samadhi states only lead to rebirth in high states, Brahma realms? And on the other hand, he's saying it leads to enlightenment. I think the key difference here is in that time when the Buddha was a child, he hadn't done the theory. He hadn't learnt those texts beforehand. You just sit there under the cool shade of the tree. Everyone goes off, leave him alone, and then just sit there and experience. He's no one's trying to persuade him of anything. No one's trying to teach him anything. He's just there together with his own experience. And so it's that memory which prompted his aspiration to gain those states of samadhi again and develop insight into the Four Noble Truths. Very interesting to notice that. It's like this kind of natural process. The path is a natural process. When we're following these five spiritual faculties, that's exactly what we're doing. We're following a natural process. We're following the ways of the mind. We're allowing our mind to just do what it does naturally if we don't distort it. If we focus on that faith, if we have faith in the Buddha, if we have faith in the Dhamma, if we have faith in the Sangha, then this will lead to a clarity and a joy in the mind. So this is very important. It's very important that we have this basis of faith. Sometimes I worry a little bit because, as everybody here knows, I sometimes take quite a textual and critical, analytical view of things. I like to look at things historically. I like to get rid of the mythology around things. And I like to take quite a critical view of the teachings. And sometimes if you do that too much, then that leads to like a kind of a dryness, to a cynicism, and becomes like an intellectual exercise or like a way of proving your points. So it's important not to get to that. But for myself, I've always just come from such a strong basis, an intuitive basis of faith in the teachings, that it's not really an issue for me. It's like this unquestioned basis of just total faith and total commitment in the teaching. When I first did my first retreat, I didn't know anything. I never learned anything, didn't know any Buddhism. And I finished the retreat and I thought, wow, I'm a Buddhist. I just want to do this for the rest of my life. Everything else is just crap. The rest of my life has just been such a waste of time. What have I been doing? Why hasn't anyone told me about this before? And so I asked the people in the center if they can give me any Dhamma books. So they showed me a couple of Dhamma books, and one of them was Seeing the Way, a book by Ajahn Chah Disciples, and I read that and I thought, oh yeah, so what? A few other things, and I thought, oh yeah. And then I went back to the teachers and I said, where's the real stuff? And so they showed me to the Majjhima Nikaya. And that was it. That was it. I just read my way through the Majjhima. And that was just like the voice of truth for me. So that's always been the two kind of real beacons of faith in my own practice. One is the meditation, and the second is the teachings from the suttas. These are the two things that I find completely inspiring. So it's important to nourish this. It's important to remember it is a very powerful thing. You can get enlightened just by being swept along by your faith. Not by stupid faith, of course, but if you have intelligent faith, karavati sadha, they say in Pali, reasoned faith, then you can become a, what they call sadhanasari, a faith follower, a faith devotee. And that can be your path, your way to enlightenment. Some people have more faith, some people have more wisdom. So that's okay. Neither one is better than the other. It doesn't mean you have only faith or only wisdom. It means like a matter of emphasis. So you can see some people are just very devotional. And if you can say, do this, and they say, great, and they go and do it. Other people, you say, do this, and they say, why? You say, well, this reason and that reason as well. So as a Dhamma teacher, it's always very pleasant if you've got lots of faith characters around you, and you say, do this, they say, oh, sadhu, 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 and they go off and do it. It's not necessarily particularly healthy. It certainly makes life easy. But if you've got more of a wisdom temperament, then get ready to suffer, you know. Your practice is going to be more kind of rough. There's going to be a lot of doubts and all of these kinds of things, inquiry and all of this stuff. You get there eventually, but just be prepared to have a bit of a rocky road. Faith road is maybe a bit slower, but more pleasant. The problem with the faith road is, of course, if it gets misdirected, if your faith is not wise faith, then you can end up really losing it, put your faith in the wrong place. So always remember that, as we say, recite in the chanting that we do before the session every Saturday. And Svatato Bhagavata Dhamma, the Dhamma is well explained by the Blessed One. Okay, so it's not, if you remember your Pali grammar, Svatato Sujatena Dhamma, the Dhamma is well expounded by Sujato. Svatato Brahmavamsena, not well expounded by Ajahn Brahm, or well expounded by anyone else, well expounded by the Buddha. And our job is to try to just be vessels for that as much as we can. So that's how I see my job, is to be a vessel for the Dhamma, and to the best of my ability, try to get out of the way and let the Dhamma speak for itself. So the Buddha always very, very strongly encouraged us. If we have faith, then we must have faith that it's worthwhile to make effort to really strive on the path. Faith does not mean, oh, okay, I can make an offering and then make a determination and then get reborn in the life of Maitreya Buddha and then he can enlighten me. No. It's not right faith. Faith does not say, I'm going to go and light some joss sticks and ask Kuan Yin to come and give me a new Mercedes. This is not right faith. Faith is that thing that's going to motivate us to effort. And if we find that our faith is not conducive to putting forth effort, then it's the wrong faith. Full stop. Mandapeya. The Buddha said that this holy life is mandapeya, is like a drink of cream. It's the cream. The best thing that we can do with our lives. Everyone who has the chance to live that holy life, you have the chance to live the life which is the cream, the topmost. In Thailand, I remember when I went to the ordination ceremony of some of my good friends who ordained just after me. And we went and we were talking to the Upajaya, and he told them that about this Thai idiom they call Glui Bo Chi, which literally means bananas ordained as nuns. And this is like bananas which are cooked in coconut milk, because in Thailand the nuns wear white. So once the bananas are in the coconut milk, then they look like nuns because they're dressed in the white. And he said, just like when you've cooked the bananas in the coconut milk, they're much more kind of rich and sweet and delicious and creamy than they are in just an ordinary banana. And he said the same ordained life is like that as well. It's much more sweet and delicious once you've cooked yourself in coconut milk. And so the Buddha said that one who practices diligently, who has a lot of energy, puts forth a lot of effort in their practice, sukho viharati, dwells happily. Somebody who doesn't put forth effort dwells unhappily and messes up what's for their own benefit. They don't achieve what's for their own benefit. Again, this is something you can all recognize, isn't it? If you feel good, if you put forth effort, you strive in your meditation. Yeah? If you take Sonya as your example and get out there on the walking path and walk up and down hour after hour after hour every day, then you'll feel happy about yourself. Whereas if you just eat lots of food, go back to your kuti and sleep, then what are you going to feel like? Are you going to feel happy? Of course not. So this is why we tell people to put forth effort, not because we want to torture them, but because we want them to be happy. If you put effort into your practice, you will be happy. Don't worry about it. Don't doubt it. Don't proliferate about it. Just get out there and do it. Keep on investigating as you're practicing. At that time, wahi bhikkhu ve sampasamanena alameva appamadena sampadetum. The Buddha said, seeing, having regard for one's own benefit, then this is enough for the putting forth of effort. Paratam vahi bhikkhave sampasamanena alameva apamadena sampadetum. Seeing the benefits for another, then this too is enough. Just that is enough for putting forth of effort. So if you see that benefit for yourself in practice, if you see that practicing makes your mind more energetic, it makes your mind more strong, more clear, makes your concentration better, then that's enough to be practicing. It's good enough. It's a good enough reason to see your own benefit. But it's also good enough to see for the benefit of others. You're practicing, you're creating. It's like this kind of psychic or spiritual energy, which is just going to naturally spill over and benefit others, whether you want it or not. And just like the three monks in the Gosinka wood, I was talking about before in the Upacilesa Sutta, the three monks, Anuruddha, Nandiya, and Kimbila. And at the end of that sutta, or actually it was another sutta talking about them, at the end of it, the Buddha said that, you know, these monks are just sitting there alone, secluded in the wood. Nobody goes there. Nobody knows that they're there. And yet if the people in that village where they go for alms, if they were to recollect these three practitioners with joy in their hearts and were to rejoice in the fact that these people are striving and putting forth effort to attain nibbana, if they're able to do that, then that would be long for their benefit and happiness. Not just the people in that village, but the people in that whole district, the people in the whole country, even the people in the whole world. If all the beings in the world were to recollect those three monks, they're practicing and striving for nibbana, then that would be long for the happiness and benefit of the whole world. So you, being here, practicing diligently, are bringing happiness and benefit and joy to so many people. And that's for everyone, both for the monks, novice, all the lay people here practicing anagarikas, everyone who comes through here is contributing to this community, visiting Sangha as well. Everyone is adding something. Everyone is creating this like spiritual happening. And as I was just speaking with Sister Pema before, and she was saying it's because of like the association with this monastery and so on, this is how she and Sister Ying have been able to end up staying on retreat in their place in Peace Ridge. And it's like this kind of web of spiritual, kind of positive spiritual energy, like this vortex starts to develop around when you have a community which is practicing well. And these things happen without us even knowing about it. Without even you knowing about it, these things are happening. Having regard to the benefit of both, both oneself and others, then this is sufficient for putting forth of effort. So ultimately, of course, this distinction between oneself and others doesn't really apply. It's only like a contingent distinction. So in Buddhism, you know, for the last 2,000 years or so, we've liked to argue about arahants versus bodhisattvas. And, you know, the battle lines are drawn and the, kind of the trenches have been dug and the howitzers have been pounding away. And the mud is slick with the blood of all of the slain in that battle. But it's all a bit silly, I think, isn't it? What's the kind of purpose? I mean, what, you know, this idea of the arahant, the kind of the selfish arahant, I'm just going to practice myself and I don't care about anyone else. You know, this kind of idea of the bodhisattva, like, you know, I'm somehow going to stop myself from being enlightened so that I can practice for the realization of all beings. Like, these ideas just don't make sense to me. They're kind of like ideas which just sort of live up in some kind of sphere of abstraction. What makes sense to me is I look into my heart and I see, is there some defilement there? Is there greed? Is there hatred? Is there delusion? That's not causing me any good. That's not causing anyone else any good. Just get rid of that. If you don't have greed, hatred, and delusion in your heart, then who are you harming? Are you harming yourself or are you harming others? None of those things can happen. None of that harm can happen unless you have those defilements in your mind. So just look for those. Get them out and develop those positive qualities and go beyond that whole distinction between yourself and others. Don't worry about, I'm going to be an arahant, I'm going to be a bodhisattva, I'm going to be a Buddha or whatever. Don't worry about those things. This is not what the Buddha said. The Buddha wasn't saying, I'm going to go so I can become a Buddha. He said, King Kusala Gawesi, what is skillful? That's what he went forth for. Not so he could sort of be something. Not because he had some abstract idea in his head of some kind of exalted spiritual being who he wanted to be. No, be because he wanted to look kinful sort of dimensi. What is skillful? What's the right way to live? What's the right way to use my mind? So we need to focus on this. Focus on what's the right way to use my mind. And we have faith that this path will actually lead there. If we follow it through with energy, with effort, then that path will lead to that goal. We have that effort, we have that mindfulness, we have that samadhi, we have that wisdom. If we have these factors, then they will lead on to the truth. One of the important things about the indriyas or the spiritual faculties is that the group of things we call indriyas is quite a lot broader than just these five spiritual faculties. In fact, there's 22 in the standard list. You have 22 indriyas. Now, the other indriyas are a miscellaneous group of things, like the eye faculty, ear faculty, many different kinds of faculties. You have the femininity and masculinity are considered to be indriyas or faculties. Life force is also like a faculty. So that's very interesting. We have like this melding in this group of 22 indriyas. We have this melding of things. On the one hand, we have what is given to us, what our life consists of, what our experience consists of, sight, sound, smell, taste, the sensory experience, the life, all of those things. These are faculties, and also the path. The factors of the path are also faculties. And so here, these two noble truths, the first noble truth and the fourth noble truth, that normally we keep distinct, are here the boundaries are being blurred. And that tells us something that's very important about these faculties, that they're impermanent. Not only are they part of the fourth noble truth, not only are they part of the path, they're also part of the first noble truth. They're anicca, dukkha, anatta. They are impermanent, they're suffering, and they're not self. They are conditioned. They come into being with certain causes and conditions. They are sustained through certain causes and conditions, and they end when those causes and conditions are not there anymore. As we keep practicing, we will see these things at deeper and deeper and deeper levels, and we will understand the whole structure of these spiritual faculties in terms of conditionality. The faith, the Buddha says in one discourse that it's natural, it's normal that somebody who has faith in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, who has purified sila, it's naturally that that will give rise to energy and that they will strive. It's natural that someone, if they're striving, putting forth effort, that they will be mindful, that they will be able to, if their mind is clear and bright and energetic, they will be able to remember what was said and done a long time ago. And this is one of the definitions of mindfulness, that you have like a good memory in that way. It's natural that if you have that good mindfulness, then, and there's a very beautiful phrase here, having made relinquishment the object, or relying on relinquishment, depending on relinquishment, one gains samadhi, one gains one pointedness of mind. So you can see here that this samadhi is not something which, you know, it's not something like a thing which you sort of go out and acquire, but it's something which is dependent on relinquishment, dependent on letting go. So it's natural that if you are putting forth that effort, then your mind will learn to let go, and you will learn to, and you will experience that samadhi. The Buddha said it's natural, it's to be expected that somebody who has that samadhi will understand. And it phrases it very beautifully in this particular sutta, we'll be able to understand. Inconceivable is the first beginning of the round of samsara. Inconceivable, anamatago, is the first beginning of this round of samsara. There is no way that we can know where all of this began. There is no way that we can penetrate and find what is the beginning of this circle, of this round of suffering and samsara. There is no way. Anamatago, it's unknown. It's inconceivable. But the complete fading away, ending, and stilling of that dark mass of ignorance, avijjatamokkhanda, that dark mass of ignorance, this is peaceful and this is sublime. So this is natural, that when one has practiced these five spiritual faculties, you've developed a mind with faith, with energy, with mindfulness, and with samadhi, it's natural that you will see this, that you will understand that this beginning of this round of samsara is inconceivable, but that when we see this truth, this is the fading away and stilling of that entire dark mass of ignorance. So this is my talk for you this evening on the five spiritual faculties. I offer that back to you for your reflection. Anyone has any comments or questions?
The mind of an arahant always dwells in universal compassion, universal loving kindness, universal sympathetic joy and equanimity. Is that correct?
Yeah, I hope so.
Why, how can someone be selfish?
Well, exactly. Exactly.
It just doesn't make sense.
Doesn't make sense, yeah. I think, like so many things, I think that it's best understood historically, or at least we should be. At least I think it's the kind of missing the point if we fail to include that historical perspective. I think what probably happened is that there were groups of monks who were selfish, who were like that, yeah, who set themselves up in monasteries where they're probably very self-sufficient and just staying there, and they probably didn't care about others. And if others said, "Oh, you should be helping us," or so on, they said, "No, no, we're just practicing for ourselves." And that is what was being criticized. So I think, and I've actually met some individuals like that. Yeah? They do exist. They're not arahants, yeah? But there may be people who could be called people who are practicing the arahant path, or people who might think that they're practicing the arahant path, but it's like a misconception of what the arahant is. And I think it's the arahant, not the actual real arahants that's being talked about there. It's actually a type. It's like almost like a caricature. And so in terms of when it's understood that way, there's certainly some truth to that. Yeah, sure.
Because I look at this a lot, moving between the two traditions. And I can't see what the big emphasis is. They just try to distinguish themselves.
Mm.
But I see people who have attainment or accomplishment in the Theravada, they seem to behave like bodhisattvas. They seem to care for, they develop their loving kindness and compassion to the point where they act for the benefit of others. And that seems to be profoundly important to them. So I can't see what the big. It seems that the motivation when you enter the path is fairly distinct, but when people have the attainment, it doesn't seem to be different.
It's true, you know, and what can you say, no? Just so many examples of people. You know, just one example of the story of Ajahn Chah when he was. You know, he just used to work so hard for people all the time, just giving. And, there's this one time and he was just going working and all these building projects and he was managing these and so on. And then they had their upasa today. He'd been giving all these teachings and things, and then they do the chanting, they do the monk's recitation of the monk's rules. And then at the end of that, then he goes and gives a Dhamma talk. So that's maybe at 10 o'clock at night, he gives a Dhamma talk for a couple of hours till midnight, and then go and sit meditation. And normally he'd just sit meditation the rest of the night. But this night he sat until about 2 o'clock in the morning and got up and went back to his kuti. And a monk who's a friend of mine, Ajnana, went with him. And as he was taking him back to his kuti, Ajahn Chah just sort of said, as an aside comment, he said, "Oh yeah, I'm feeling a bit tired tonight. I've had malaria for the last week. I think I'll have a bit of a rest." Ajahn Chah was just astounded, you know. People die from malaria. He was like this 60-year-old man who was just working so hard and just wouldn't stop.
Well, it's the same with Mahasi Sayadaw.
Yeah.
Spent his whole life teaching, and in Burma there's something like 400 Mahasi centers.
Yeah, yeah, just working to help others.
And you know, you get others in the Mahayana tradition who claim that they treat all beings equally, but they're not interested in anybody else except their own group.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a label.
It's label, and I think that's the best way of understanding it rather than in terms of the schools. It's like, it's an ancient dialogue which was going on, has been going on for a long time, and for which there's no solution, you know? Everyone has to make that choice, yeah? In the morning when we get up, well, we have to make that choice. Am I going to sit in meditation, or am I going to go and do some work and help somebody? So every day we face that choice, and there's no kind of right solution. But as I was saying in the talk, I think that ultimately, really, it just breaks down. I think the people that I've known who have been quote unquote selfish, on the selfish arahant path. Hey, that's what I want to be, selfish arahant. And they never seem to get anywhere in their spiritual path. And their meditation doesn't go very well, and they don't end up being very inspiring people. But also it can happen, the other way can happen, if you do too much for others and just do too much service, you can get burnt out.